Media headlines. Iran's president says an agreement on reviving the 2015 deal is not possible without giving necessary guarantees to Tehran and closing its case at the IAEA. Iran condemns foreign interference in its internal affairs, saying countries known for warmongering and violence cannot preach others on human rights. And the family of the Palestinian journalist fatally shot by Israeli forces files an official lawsuit with the International Criminal Court demanding justice for her killing. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in for World News. Our top story, Iran's president says reaching an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal is not possible without closing Tehran's case at the International Atomic Energy Agency. Ebrahim Raisi says the IAEA has officially acknowledged 15 times that Iran's activities are based on commitment and far from deviation. Raisi said that Europe must prove its policies are independent from Washington. He said the revival of the 2015 accord hinges on guarantees provided by parties to the agreement. Raisi was meeting with his French counterpart on the sidelines of the 77th UN General Assembly. Washington broke its promises under the deal by withdrawing back in May of 2018. Tehran says the European sides have not acted according to their obligations under the JCPOA. And now joining us out of London is Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, for his take on the story. Hello, Sayed. Pleasure to have you join us here on Press TV for this story. Now, Sayed, Iranian president's demand here, and this has been a serious stickler in talks. Why? Because it's really redundant to have sanctions removed for the IAEA to make accusations and come up with some kind of finding. And a lot of people believe that the IAEA for a long time has not been apolitical. So therefore, it could really just be a redundant issue if you're going to remove the sanctions, revive the JCPOA, and the IAEA does something to basically put it right back in tatters a month later. Your thoughts on the story, please.
Well, I think the Iranian establishment is very right in being very, very cautious and very, very skeptical about why this is insistence on the IAEA safeguards issue is just not going away. I mean, the reality of the matter is that, as Raisi has said very clearly, that so many times, he says 15, well, we'll take his word on that, 15 times they've gone and inspected, they've checked, and they've given the nuclear program a clean bill of health. It seems that about a year ago in particular, the IAEA, under the Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi, has leaned increasingly towards an Israeli stance. I mean, Grossi actually visited Israel as well. And let's not forget that this is the same Mr. Grossi who heads the IAEA that is meant to bring Israel to the table in terms of its nuclear violations, essentially. 400 nuclear weapons, pretty good violation by any measure, given that the Israelis don't even want to come onto the table of any kind of on nuclear proliferation agreements. They don't want to be inspected by the IAEA. Yet here was Mr. Grossi going off to Israel to take his orders. Many would allege that he actually is in cahoots with the Israeli agenda on the JCPOA. And of course, we know that Israel does not want the JCPOA to go ahead. And I think to consider the IAEA now as some sort of independent outfit, if it was ever going to be an independent outfit, well, certainly it's lost all credibility in the eyes of anybody who looks on neutrally. You know, he's also made some really strange statements. Mr. Grossi, for instance, warned that the lack of progress in verifying the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program will have consequences on the regional security landscape. So it's always very threatening language for somebody who's supposed to be neutral on the whole issue. For him, it's surely only a concern to look at what the facts and the figures are in terms of nuclear output on the ground. To start postulating about what happens on the regional security landscape is a bit of a call for him to make. So I would say overall, absolutely, it would backfire on Iran if they left this kind of door open for the Israelis to manipulate the IAEA to come back, even if the JCPOA was revived. And it does seem like a little trick up the sleeve that they've tried to keep a few cards there.
All right, always a pleasure. Stay safe, and thank you for joining us on the program. From London, Sayed Mohsen Abbas joining us. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson has once again slammed foreign interference in the country's internal matters. He says certain countries with a long history of warmongering and violence are in no position to preach to others on the issue of human rights. Nasser Kanani was reacting to meddlesome remarks by some American and European officials on the case of a young Iranian woman who collapsed at a police station and then later died at a hospital. He advised those countries to avoid opportunism and instrumental use of human rights. Kanani said the U.S. is the biggest violator of the rights of Iranians by keeping its failed maximum pressure policy and economic terrorism. He said the West turning a blind eye to crimes committed by allies across the world only reveals its hypocrisy on the issue of human rights. Kanani called for Western governments to improve their own human rights situation and stop seditious activities. Family of slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh has submitted an official complaint to the International Criminal Court demanding justice for her killing. In a statement, Abu Akleh's family said footage shows she was explicitly targeted by Israeli forces despite wearing a vest marked press. Statement added, regime forces even prevented her colleague from helping her after she was shot. Abu Akleh was killed on May 11th while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Earlier, an Israeli probe claimed reporter was likely shot unintentionally by an Israeli soldier. Abu Akleh's family, however, says the regime is trying to obscure the truth and avoid responsibility for killing the journalist. Pro-Russian separatists in several Ukrainian regions say they will hold referendums on joining Russia in the coming days. Self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic passed a law earlier Tuesday outlining the details of the proposed vote. Russian media has cited sources as saying the vote is set to take place between September 23rd and the 27th. The self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic also plans a vote on secession from Ukraine in the coming days as well. And authorities in Russian-controlled southern Kherson region and southeastern Zaporizhia region also say they will hold similar referendums no later than the 27th of September. Moscow says it's up to the residents of those regions to decide if they want to be part of Russia.
From the very beginning of the special military operation, and before that, we've been saying that the peoples of the prospective territories should decide their own fate. The whole current situation confirms that they want to be master of their own fate.
Now, coordinated moves have sparked Kiev's angry reaction, with the government pledging to eliminate Moscow's threat. The Ukrainian foreign minister says the proposed referendums will not change anything on the ground. The U.S., Germany, and NATO have called the planned votes a sham. NATO says the referendums are yet another escalation in the Ukraine war. France has called them a travesty. And now, latest updates from fighting in Ukraine. Government forces there have advanced further into the east, reclaiming more areas from Russian troops. Video posted online shows Ukrainian soldiers walking on a road in Bilohorivka after regaining control of the area just west of the Russian-held city of Lysychansk. Ukrainian officials say soldiers are now in full control of the area and preparing to retake the entire province of Luhansk. Ukrainian troops have launched a counteroffensive in the eastern region since driving Russian forces out of northeastern Kharkiv province earlier this month. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres opens the 77th session of General Assembly in New York with a stark warning to international leaders that the world is grappling with multiple crises. Here he is.
Excellencies, we need action across the board. Let's have no illusions. We are in rough seas. A winter of global discontent is on the horizon. A cost of living crisis is raging. Trust is crumbling. Inequalities are exploding. And our planet is burning. People are hurting, with the most vulnerable suffering the most.
Now, this is the first in-person gathering of world leaders at the 193-member General Assembly after 2 years of COVID restrictions. UN chiefs stressed cooperation and dialogue are the only path forward, adding that no power or group alone can call the shots. He said geopolitical divides have made the world unable to tackle major challenges threatening the future of humanity. Guterres also pointed out the dire state of the planet, lashing out at fossil fuel companies. War in Ukraine and mounting economic and environmental crises are on top of the agenda during this year's UN General Assembly meeting. And earlier, we discussed Brazil's upcoming presidential election with our guests in our news review program. Here it is.
Time now for the news review. Now, less than 2 weeks ahead of Brazil's presidential elections, an opinion poll shows incumbent Jair Bolsonaro lagging behind his main rival, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. According to an IPEC survey, the far-right president is now backed by 31% of the voters, that against 47% who support former President Lula. The study expects a runoff in which Lula would win by 54% of the ballots against 35% for Bolsonaro. The incumbent has seen his popularity drop due to his controversial management of the coronavirus pandemic and the economy. He said that he will retire from politics if he fails to win the upcoming vote. Okay, two guests will be joining me to shed some more light on this and discuss that a bit. So our own correspondent, Camila Escalante. Both of them are in Brazil. Bruno Biclini, academic and political scientist, is also there. Good to see you both. So, Camila, starting with you, tell us about the campaign plans. Only 2 weeks remain. So what are the two main contenders are going to do? And should we expect any change in the opinion polls that I just talked about?
Well, we saw 3 days of a tour here through the southern region of Brazil, where I am now. And sorry, I'm hearing a little bit of feedback, but Lula da Silva came down to the southern region of Brazil for a 3-state tour where he held massive rallies in what is known as a stronghold for the right wing and Jair Bolsonaro. But we saw massive turnout in favor of Lula da Silva, and as you said, the polls actually showed Lula with a slight boost. Now we see Jair Bolsonaro growing a little bit desperate, perhaps, with the risk that this could all end in just one round, because Lula is kind of right there on the margin, where he could potentially win without need for a second round. But it's difficult to say as of right now. Today we saw Jair Bolsonaro at the opening of the general debate of the UN General Assembly in New York. He was the first speaker, and he's being charged by his critics of actually using the podium at the United Nations, where he's supposed to represent the whole of Brazil and the Brazilian people and government, and using it for political campaign purposes. He made a number of false claims there at the podium, including saying that he had worked in favor of many women's issues, that he had helped stomp out femicide. And he also said that under his government, under his administration, that there are lower numbers of rural area of violence. Ask any of the agrarian reform and land movements here who fight against the large landholders. So a lot of false information was coming from that grand podium, that grand platform, and people are very angry about that and are seeing it as a desperate attempt to try to get together a little bit more support so that Lula doesn't take it in that first round.
All right. Now, Bruni, tell us what is it that has made Jair Bolsonaro fall from grace? And we believe that maybe he's also expecting to lose this time around.
Well, Bolsonaro is what it is, and he doesn't need any enemy. He elects his enemies, and his behavior is so bad. For example, like the colleague said before, he tried to make an attempt to be more sympathizing with women, but he's a womanizer. He made a sexist joke
it's more
in
than
front
sympathy.
Of his wife during September the 7th. So we would say that he's his worst enemy, and his political economy during the three and a half years in government was strictly related to the Chicago boy Minister of Economy of himself, Paulo Guedes. It was just like the Chilean political economy during dictatorship. And then in the last 3 to 4 months, he tried to make an attempt like used to do Mauricio Macri in Argentina, doing some social policies, but without losing the gap that we are now. For example, Brazil is the second biggest worldwide food producer, and we have 33 million people under poverty and hungry and hunger people. So
right. Now, Camila, tell us what is it that Brazilian people are mostly asking for? What do they expect their new president to do for them?
Absolutely. I mean, some of the same things that we've seen people call for in all countries right now amid the international conflict overseas is people want price stability. They want a freeze on inflation. They want to be able to afford the basic necessities that they've always needed. And they want, you know, secure jobs. They want employment, access to housing. You know, just very basic, practical economic measures is what they want implemented in this country. And they don't see Bolsonaro as being fit to govern over the coming problems that are going to happen in the world. Like you said, following coronavirus, and now in the context of this international conflict, they want the same common sense measures that Lula and his government applied when they were in government previously. That's what they're demanding right now. So what Lula is doing right now is he's meeting with different sectors, as artists, social movements, mm-hmm. even former presidential candidates, and even some people, some political leaders of the center right. He's trying to bring together all sorts of people who are on the fence and who don't agree with Bolsonaro's policies and bring them over mm-hmm. to his coalition to support him going forward in these elections. We've actually seen a number of endorsements from people that we didn't think we would see endorsing Lula coming forth and saying that a vote for a third party candidate, any of the smaller candidates with single digit support right now in the polls, is a wasted vote. And it is in fact a vote for Bolsonaro right now, when we're in a situation where the people say that this is an election about fascism or about returning stability and dignity to the country.
Okay, we hope a better future for all Brazilians. Thank you so much, Camila Escalante, Bruno Biclini, both of them in Brazil.
And that's a wrap for your latest. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
After more than a year has passed since U.S. President Joe Biden took office, the reality we're witnessing is the continuation of former U.S. President Donald Trump's most aggressive immigration policies towards immigrants. The Biden administration not only cannot fulfill its promises that it has given to immigrants, but also insists on racist, xenophobic, and repressive views against immigration. The treatment of illegal immigrants in U.S. violates human rights in many cases, and the number of those who enter this country through the Mexican border and are victims of physical and mental abuse is not small. For example, the U.S. Republican Party, by abusing the immigrants and transferring them to the regions under the leadership of Democrats, is trying to take political advantage of this measure and put more pressure on the Biden administration. We have taken a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has written, Some migrants who were flown to the island of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts said on Thursday, 15th of September, they were duped about their destination, and Democratic leaders called for a probe of the move by Florida's Republican governor to send them there from Texas. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's up for re-election this November and seen as a possible presidential contender in 2024, took credit for the two flights, which originated in San Antonio, Texas, and stopped in Florida on their way to Martha's Vineyard. The White House and residents of the vacation enclave called it a political stunt, as Ron DeSantis joins Republican governors from Texas and Arizona in sending migrants north. The governors have sought to highlight the two parties' differences on immigration policy and shift the burden of caring for immigrants to Democratic areas. For months, Texas and Arizona have sent busloads of migrants to the Democratic-run cities of New York, Chicago, and Washington. A Martha's Vineyard airport official said the two flights on Wednesday, 14th of September, carried about 50 migrants, mostly from Venezuela. Hours after the planes landed, two buses sent by Texas Governor Greg Abbott, another Republican facing re-election this November, dropped off migrants in a Washington neighborhood, not far from Vice President Kamala Harris's official residence on Thursday, 15th of September. One Venezuelan migrant who arrived at Martha's Vineyard identified himself as Luis, a 27-year-old, and said he and nine relatives were promised a flight to Massachusetts, along with shelter, support for 90 days, help with work permits, and English lessons. He said they were surprised when their flight landed on Martha's Vineyard. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said Republican governors were using migrants as political pawns. Several Democrats, including Charlie Crist, Ron DeSantis' opponent in Florida, and California Governor Gavin Newsom, have called on federal authorities to investigate the matter. Britain's Guardian newspaper explains more about this story. Attorneys representing Venezuelan asylum seekers flown thousands of miles to an affluent holiday island in Massachusetts at the behest of Republican governors have formally requested authorities open a criminal investigation, claiming the victims were induced to board airplanes and cross state lines under false pretenses. Lawyers for Civil Rights, a Boston-based group representing 30 of the 48 people flown from Texas to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts on Wednesday, 14th of September, said individuals working in concert with state officials, including the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, made numerous false promises to the migrants, including of work opportunities, schooling for their children, and immigration assistance, in order to induce them to travel. According to Lawyers for Civil Rights, which is providing pro bono legal assistance to the asylum seekers, the Venezuelans were duped in what was essentially a coordinated political stunt targeting vulnerable people based on their race and country of origin. Those flown to the holiday island of Martha's Vineyard included women and children as young as 2 years old. Lawyers for Civil Rights has written to the U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins and the Massachusetts Attorney General, Maura Healey, requesting they open a criminal investigation, as we strongly believe that criminal laws were broken by the perpetrators of this stunt. In a statement, Lawyers for Civil Rights said, "This cowardly political stunt has placed our clients in peril. Upon arrival, numerous individuals had to be rushed to hospital in need of medical care. Some now have immigration hearings as early as Wednesday, 21st of September, thousands of miles away." The story has also been covered by Al Jazeera's website from a different angle. Massachusetts state officials announced migrants were flown to the U.S. island of Martha's Vineyard recently in what critics have denounced as a cruel political stunt by Republican lawmakers of being moved to a military base. Approximately 50 migrants, including about half a dozen children, boarded buses on Friday, 16th of September, to head to the ferry to Cape Cod, where Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker said they would be housed temporarily at Joint Base Cape Cod. The group was flown to Martha's Vineyard without warning on Wednesday night, 14th of September, as part of an escalating effort by Republican governors to call attention to what they view as U.S. President Joe Biden's failure to secure the U.S.-Mexico border amid record attempted crossings. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has taken credit for transporting the migrants from Texas to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, though the legal basis for the Florida government to round up migrants in a different state remained unclear. The migrants said they had recently been admitted into the United States on a fast-track permit known as humanitarian parole after leaving Venezuela and had been staying at a shelter in San Antonio, Texas. Rachel Self, a Boston immigration lawyer who gave legal assistance to some of the migrants, said they had been lured onto planes under false pretenses.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and let us ponder on a maxim from the Holy Prophet's fourth infallible successor, Imam Zainul Abidin, or Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, who during his captivity in the court of the tyrant Yazid in Damascus boldly said, "Beware of matters against which God has warned you. Abstain from matters from which God has ordered you to abstain. Do not copy the inclination of those who regarded this world as a permanent abode."
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the innate of seeking justice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of having the innate of seeking justice, or fitrah of seeking justice. We see that it is inside the mankind that mankind is striving for the justice, and it wants justice, it seeks justice. And wherever we see oppression, wherever we see a sin, wherever we see someone is taking the rights of others away, we start speaking out, we start shouting out, and we start to protest against such actions. And this protest, this feeling that we have, which we feel bad about the things, and through this feeling we judge people, this judgment is all based on our innate, because whoever does not observe justice, we don't like that person. We straightforward say or have a feeling in ourselves that this person is not right because he's taking over the rights of the others. He is oppressing others. We have many examples. For example, there were protests around the world when we had the incident of George Floyd, when the Yemeni children are bombarded by the Saudi Arabia, the people are shouting out, they're protesting. The things that are happening in Palestine, we can see that there are many things, many other examples which we see in our society or locally. We can see many examples around us, and we feel bad about this. Why do we feel bad? It's because it's in our inside, it's in our innate, that is telling us that this is not justice, it is oppression, it is injustice. And therefore, we feel bad or we protest against such actions. And this is what we say, that the innate is seeking justice. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of innate seeking justice. And we said that it's in our innate, it's in our fitrat, it's in our nature that we seek justice. And therefore, we see that from the signs of the intellectual or intellect is that al-amalu bi-sunnati al-adl. It is said that we need to observe the justice, we need to practice justice. And therefore, we see that Allah Matabatabai, even when he talks about the justice to be the part of innate, he discusses that, he says that the justice is equal to goodness. And the justice must have goodness in it. And if it is not having a goodness in it, then obviously this is not a justice, it is something else. And we know that the goodness itself is something which ourselves like it. We like to be good, we like goodness, we like to be dealt good by the people. And because we like all these things, this goodness, therefore we are inclined towards the goodness, and we are being, we can say, attracted towards the goodness. And whenever we are attracted towards the goodness, it means that there is something good in it. And the justice itself is something that whenever somebody observes the justice, the people, they like it, they praise the person. And even if it is against some people, but because he dealt with them with the justice, they even admire it. So therefore, this goodness, because it is being observed by the people, people like it, and people want the goodness, and we know that the goodness is part of justice. Therefore, justice is also something which is inside us, and we are inclined towards this justice and towards the goodness, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With delight.
A Palestinian farmer has discovered an ancient Byzantine-era mosaic when preparing to plant an olive tree on his plot of land in the Gaza Strip. The farmer and his son have been carefully excavating the area for 3 months since spring. The pair dug out three patches, revealing glimpses of an ornate mosaic with intricate images of birds, flora and tile patterns. Its full size is roughly 23 square meters. The discovery has set off excitement amongst archaeologists. Experts say it is one of the most well-preserved specimens, with precision in graphics and richness in colors. According to archaeologists, the mosaic pavement dates back to the 5th and 7th centuries. Last month, another Palestinian farmer found a rare stone sculpture while working on his land, which dates back to around 2500 BC. They're back as India has revealed or released several of them into the grasslands of Kuna National Park after a 70-year absence in the country. The eight radio-collared African cheetahs made the long journey from Namibia. The big cats were released during a ceremony by Prime Minister Narendra Modi that coincided with his birthday. After their acclimation in the national park, they will be released into a five-hectare spread of land in central India, covered by grassland and forest. The felines will share the landscape with other animals and roam with leopards, sloths and striped hyenas. Their reintroduction is the culmination of a 13-year effort to restore the species, which vanished from the country decades ago. Another 12 cheetahs are expected to join the fledgling Indian population next month from South Africa. With more funding, the country hopes to gradually increase the population of cheetahs to around 40. World Cleanup Day unites millions of volunteers, governments and organizations to tackle the global waste problem and build a sustainable world. People in several countries joined the efforts again for a waste-free world. Volunteers were seen in mangrove forests in the suburb of Bangkok. They collected more than 1.5 tons of rubbish in just a few hours. Trash picking events were also held in the Philippines and Vietnam. In Hanoi, hundreds, mostly students, armed with metal tongs and sacks, walked along major roads. They said their aim is to raise awareness about protecting the environment. In Manila, people cleaned up the city's beaches that are major tourist attractions. The annual cleanup day has been running for over a decade, from divers collecting marine debris to children picking up trash on beaches have just one goal: make our planet a cleaner place.
Chinese astronauts are celebrating their first ever mid-autumn festival in outer space while sharing their otherworldly experience with people on Earth. The crew had a close-up view of the moon from China's Tiangong space station and their third month in space. On the occasion, the ground crew organized a series of celebrations, including a family reunion for the astronauts. The ground crew also prepared elaborate food packages that had been prepared before the launch of the spacecraft. Typically, the traditional festival is kicked off by the first viewing of the full moon on the 15th day of the 8th month of the lunar calendar. Despite being able to see the moon rise and set 16 times a day, the astronauts say the moon is special on this occasion. forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with many expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice, and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals. Most of the time, you have to visit an exhibition to see art. But what if art comes to see you instead? Well, a group of artists in Mali have created a floating art venue that will travel up and down the River Niger. It's called the Pirogue du Zem, which is a floating vessel. It's designed to host plays, exhibitions, dance shows, and so much more. The idea is to make art a movable feast that is no longer restricted to fixed venues in cities and accessible to all people. The project was created by a local artist and architect who had a vision to bring art to the masses. The vessel is 20 meters long and 6 meters wide, built with storage and enough space for exhibition. Government officials say the floating venue will showcase Mali's talents and creativity while attracting tourists.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Colombia is known for its tourist attractions and is full of breathtaking natural sights such as beaches, mountains, deserts, and forests. The South American nation is also one of the few places that give tourists the chance to have an encounter with whales. Every year, from July to October, domestic and foreign tourists flock to Colombia's Pacific coast to catch a glimpse of humpback whales. The large animals reach the coast after traveling thousands of kilometers from Antarctica and southern Chile. But for visitors, there are strict rules to help preserve the area and the whales. Tourists are now being welcomed for whale watching after a two-year hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic. This is also the time when humpback whales start their reproductive process. Art restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine the anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism.
Illegal hunting and hybridization with American crocodiles have for decades threatened their populations, with some species being on the verge of extinction. But there are some people who put their lives at risk to save the natural heritage. A Cuban researcher has released a baby crocodile that was confiscated from illegal hunters back into the wild. It was a happy moment for Etienne Perez, who went waist-deep in the dark water of Zapata Swamp to free Cuban crocs, the smallest known range of any living crocodile species. Cuban scientists were racing for quite some time to save the rarest crocodile. The government has protected virtually all of the vast swamp, widely considered to be the best preserved in the Caribbean. But the scientists say more efforts are needed to save the nature.
Releasing crocodiles seized from poachers is really impressive because we return the animal to a free life in the wild. In the case of the animals in the hatchery, we are trying to increase the historical range of the Cuban crocodile and, of course, increase the number of these individuals in the wild.
Cuban scientists estimate that around 4,000 crocodiles continue to live in the wild. But because the area they prefer within the wetland is relatively small, a climate-related disaster, increasingly common now globally, could wipe out the brunt of the population. They say illegal hunting for decades is also threatening crocodile populations. A wide range of cutting-edge digital technology is grabbing the limelight at the 2022 China International Fair for Trade in Services, which is underway in Beijing. The exhibition is featuring a wide range of products, including artificial intelligence, virtual reality, metaverse, and 5G. Visitors can be seen taking virtual reality driving lessons and enjoying scenarios, including different road and weather conditions, wearing VR kits. It's the leading and largest comprehensive fair for trade and services in China. This year, an increasing number of traditional service companies are speeding up their transformations, resorting to smart technologies. The event has set up 9 thematic exhibitions, including cultural and tourism services, education and sports services, hygiene and health services, engineering, consulting, and environmental services. Foam is fun to play with, particularly for kids, but when it's mixed with art, it also becomes a grown-up matter. And that's what a German artist has done, creating a sea of rainbow-colored foam as an interactive art piece and allowing the audience to enjoy themselves and become part of the art. Colors mixed were by Stephanie Luning were turned into rainbow-hued foam cascading down the stairs. The performance was called Island of Foam, version 18. Excited children jumped in as soon as the bubbly sea reached the base of the stairs, delighted to be playing in the rainbow playground. The art piece is made up of largely of water and a food coloring. The artist says she loves working in public spaces and reaching a broad audience of all ages.
Because I like to be surprised by the result myself, and I like to work with this that you never know how it's going to turn out. You have the wind, the weather conditions, the locations, the audience. You never know how the people are going to respond and how the artwork turns out. And that's really what I like a lot, and also how to reach a broad audience.
However, Stephanie says there's tons of work behind all the fun, and cleaning up the mess can be hard. Interactive art is a form of art that achieves this purpose by involving the audience. The immersive art piece is part of the Greenwich and Docklands International Festival, an annual festival of performing arts and outdoor theatre.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The death of Queen Elizabeth has raised much discussion about independence of Commonwealth realms. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the second part. Al Jazeera English wrote this headline saying, Queen's death accelerates ex-colonies' push to ditch UK crown. According to Al Jazeera English, removing the British monarch as head of state would complete decolonization process, Jamaican academic says. The death of Queen Elizabeth will accelerate the push by former UK colonies to ditch the British crown, experts and advocates have said amid heightened anti-colonial sentiments in the remaining Commonwealth realms. Despite the collapse of the British Empire in the last century, 14 countries have kept the monarch as their head of state after gaining independence. But with King Charles ascending to the throne after the death of his mother recently, several nations are expected to break ties with Buckingham Palace in the years to come and move towards the full republican system that does not recognize the monarch. There was already stirrings of republicanism in a number of these different countries, but as long as the Queen was alive, there was that sentimental attachment to her person, not to the institution, but to the Queen herself, said Brooke Newman, an associate professor of history at Virginia Commonwealth. Now that she is gone, there is much less of a sentimental attachment to the institution of the monarchy, and then even less so to the person of Charles. The Commonwealth realms include several Caribbean nations where republicanism is gaining momentum, as well as Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, and a few island nations in the Pacific. While the Prime Minister of New Zealand has ruled out the possibility of a divorce from the Crown in the foreseeable future, in the Caribbean it is a different story. Last November, Barbados renounced the Crown and became a republic, prompting similar conversations in other countries in the region. And since the Queen's death, the Prime Minister of nearby Antigua and Barbuda, an island country of nearly 100,000 people, announced plans to hold a referendum on keeping King Charles as head of state. Newman said the Crown's Commonwealth realm will shrink significantly in the coming decades. It's going to be happening during the reign of Charles. If he lives for another 20 to 25 years, I'll be very surprised if there are a large number of Commonwealth realms by the time his son takes the throne, she told Al Jazeera. NBC News also wrote, in recent years, former British colonies, especially countries where black residents were enslaved by their colonial masters, have been demanding accountability from the royal family, which became fabulously rich on the backs of slaves. So while there have been tributes to the Queen throughout the Commonwealth, hundreds gathered in an Anglican cathedral in the Ugandan capital of Kampala for a service honoring Elizabeth, there has been simmering discontent too. In March, the now heir to the throne, Prince William, his wife Kate, Prince Edward, and the Countess of Wessex were met with demonstrations and demands for reparations for slavery while on a royal tour to the Caribbean that took them to former colonies Jamaica, Belize, as well as the Bahamas. Many residents were especially incensed that their countries were helping pay for the royal tour. Why are we footing the bill for the benefit of a regime whose rise to greatness was fueled by extinction, enslavement, colonization, and degradation of people of this land? Bahama National Reparations Committee declared in an open letter, adding, "Why are we being made to pay again?" According to CBS News, in Australia, a Commonwealth country where many revered Queen Elizabeth, newly elected Prime Minister Anthony Albanese government has already raised the possibility of holding a referendum to jettison Charles and the monarchy became a republic. The same goes for Canada, where the support for having a foreigner as head of state has also been eroding. "I prefer someone from Windsor than the House of Windsor to be head of state," Flavio Volk, president of Canada's Automotive Parts Manufacturers Association, told Reuters after Elizabeth died. Guardian had this headline saying, "Can the Commonwealth survive the death of the Queen?" Guardian wrote, "The Queen's death has been marked throughout the Commonwealth with a period of official mourning, but not far below the surface lies a simmering anger among those grappling with the legacy of colonialism. Some Commonwealth countries are already taking action. After Barbados became a republic last year, Jamaica is promising its own referendum. In the streets and on online message boards, there was anger at a legacy many Kenyans see as brutal and filled with atrocities that have never been properly investigated." Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. This week, we're examining how a Protestant settler from Ireland, who fought in the Boer War and in loyalist militias in Ireland, eventually led a Jewish fighting force in Palestine. This was later transformed into the militias that carried out ethnic cleansing operations against the Palestinian people. We'll be looking at how John Henry Patterson is now remembered in Ireland and in Israel. As usual, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi on the story of this Protestant settler from Ireland who ended up influencing the founding of the Zionist militias that ultimately became the Israeli army in 1948.
Recently in West Belfast, in the north of Ireland, a large and detailed mural has appeared extolling the career of Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson. Patterson was a British Army officer who was described by Benjamin Netanyahu as the godfather of the Israel occupation forces. Who was Patterson, and what does his history tell us about the affinities between settler colonialism in Ireland and in Palestine? Born in 1867, Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson of British settler stock in Ireland enlisted in the British military at 17 years of age.